So good evening, everyone, and a formal welcome to lesson four of Journey of the Soul. Tonight, we are discussing where we go, heaven and hell. That's going to be tonight's topic, a very important class and lesson in this conversation of Journey of the Soul. Many people have questions on these topics. It's possible some of you even were attracted to this course because of this topic. So just a reminder to please mute yourself if you didn't yet. We will have opportunities to ask questions, and you'll be able to unmute yourself when the time comes, just for the successful and background of the class. It would be helpful for everyone to be on mute. So thank you very much for that. So a rabbi comes to this elderly woman and advises her that at her advanced age, it may be a good thing if she would start thinking, about the hereafter. So she says to the rabbi, "Oh, I do that all the time, regardless of what room I walk into, the kitchen, the living room, my bedroom. I'm always asking myself, what am I hereafter?" I see some smiles. Okay, good.
You'll be here till Wednesday, right? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, thank you. So, we have been discussing the journey of the soul. Just a couple of, just to refresh very briefly in a couple of words, in our first three lessons, we talked about the soul's origin. We talked about the soul while it's here, living life in this world, in a body. And we talked about the immediate phase when the soul departs from the body and untethers or becomes uncoupled from the body and begins its transition to the next phase of life or life after life. And that's where we are. And we talked about, in general terms, we talked about what the early phase is like. We also talked last week about how it is from the perspective of the loved ones who remain behind here in this world. And today we're going to speak about the next phase of the soul's journey. And to introduce the topic, I'm actually going to share a screen, and we're going to start with a video. I think it's a very powerful video and illustration and introduction, if you will, to our conversation tonight. So just give me 1 minute and we will get started here.
Birth and death are as contradictory as night and light. But they are strangely associated with an identical Hebrew word, kever. Kever means a tomb where a body is buried. But kever also means a womb where life is formed. A womb is a gateway to life, while a tomb is a gateway to afterlife. But is there an afterlife? Or does laying a body to rest in a grave mark the absolute end? If it were within our power to interview a soul, we would undoubtedly glean insight into afterlife. Instead, we have chosen to eavesdrop on a set of twins in their mother's womb to shed some light on the before life.
Hey, twin, I'm scared of birth. Why? It's the end of existence. We get ejected. We're finished.
I'm also anxious, twin, but I'm not scared. Birth is supposed to be a transition to the real life.
Huh. Don't give me the hiccups with your afterbirth real-life fantasies. How can life be supported without an umbilical cord and amniotic fluid?
Well, maybe it's a radically different form of life. Maybe we won't need the cord.
I wish you were right. I keep kicking that thing away from my neck.
Stop spinning for a minute and imagine, twin. After birth, we will enter a ginormous universe filled with light and with air that we will breathe through our mouths.
Come on, Grow some brain cells, will you? Mouths are not for breathing. Besides, if your postnatal paradise existed, why has no one ever returned from that realm? Forget it. Once we leave here, we collapse into cold, dry nothingness and wither into eternal gloom.
I don't think Mother would allow that to happen. She nurtures us in this cozy womb. She sends us nutrients for months on end. For what purpose? Just to end it all with birth? No. Mother has greater plans for us than that.
Now you're beginning to sound infantile. Do you see a mother lurking in some corner of the womb? Not a trace. Show me a mother. And as for your nutrients, can't you feel that annoying cord? Don't exchange empirical for fantastical.
Thankfully, these two delightful infants made it safely to the other side. They grew up in the universe that one had described and the other had denied. And until today, they continue their clamorous debate. It is only that the topic of contention has slightly shifted from, is there life after the womb, to, is there life after the tomb?
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to those who are just joining. Hi, Joanne. Hello, Jim. Hello, Nadine. Just a reminder. Hi there. Hi. So we just watched this video, and the central message of the parable in this video was that there's something beyond our present state of existence, beyond the earthly life that we're familiar with here in this world. And the fact that we can barely comprehend that there would be another reality outside of our own, something that we have a hard time envisioning, is actually to be expected. In fact, if we had an understanding of what the next world was like, that would be kind of novel. That would be pretty awesome. The fact that we don't is actually what's expected. We can't really fathom a reality outside of our own present reality. We can't have an understanding of the afterlife because we're not there. In as much as when a baby is in the womb, it can't imagine life outside of the womb in this world, in our reality. When we are alive here in this world, we can't really fathom, understand, or grasp any life that may exist beyond our own. So we don't actually die. We're actually born twice. As we just clarified, we're born once from the womb, and we're born another time from the tomb. And we go on to a new phase of life. Today's lesson, we're going to be discussing the afterlife. As I noted, many of us have questions on the topic, and today's class is going to present the uniquely Jewish understanding of this topic. You may be surprised at some of the things you learned tonight. You may be surprised that we are going to, you may have to shift from what your perception was on these ideas up until now. So let's begin with, I'm going to ask you to share with us, very brief, because I want to hear as many perspectives as possible. Please keep it to one line. Please unmute yourself and share any questions that you have about the afterlife. What question comes to mind that you may have about the afterlife? Please unmute and share with us your brief thought as a question of what you want to know about the afterlife. Lou, looks like you're unmuted. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm thinking of a question. So one question has to do with the individuality and uniqueness of the soul. If there's reincarnation, transmigration, is that what it would be? If after we die in this world and our soul goes to another body in the future,
So you're touching on reincarnation, and I'm gonna stop you right here, and we're going to be discussing reincarnation next week. So I'm not going to be addressing it tonight. God willing, next week we're gonna have a whole lesson dedicated to reincarnation. Also, a fascinating topic. But tonight we're gonna stay focused on the afterlife. Anyone have a quick question that they would be looking to know? Donna, are you unmuted? Can't hear you. Anyone else? Nick, please go ahead. Donna, we'll come back to you.
So my main question is, as the moment you die, what exactly does Judaism have to say about the experience that the person has?
The soul, that the departed soul?
Right. Yeah, like what
happens? Actually, we actually had a whole, last week's class was very much focused on the immediate first week or month after the passing, and I would recommend for you to listen to the audio of last week's class, but you'll get some insight tonight as well. Anyone else? Deborah, please.
Do our souls unite with those we love?
Our souls unite with those we love? Great question. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else? Lynn.
It's Larry.
Larry.
When the Mashiach comes and we're all supposed to get together as families, do we share one soul or do we meet without souls?
Great, great question. You're asking when Mashiach comes, you're asking about after the resurrection of the dead.
Yes.
So you're asking if we're all going to be back into our own bodies or if we're just going to be something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or who gets the soul?
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. And that also may be addressed next week as well, because we're touching on reincarnation. Anyone else? Okay, I think we, Ron, last question, go ahead.
What happens in the, say, washing machine, quote unquote, where you, what's the place you go to, Gehenna or something, up to 12 months, right? So what happens in that period, generally?
Excellent question. We will be addressing that tonight. Thank you very much, Ron. Okay, so in addition to the questions that we heard, many of them which we will be addressing tonight, there is the question that many of us have, but we may be afraid to ask. Number one, is there a hell? Do we believe in one? More importantly, am I going there? Anyone have that question? I do.
No.
So we're going to have to back up a little bit, and we're going to have to understand what is hell from the Jewish perspective. Does it exist, and what is it? And again, before we advance, I want to ask everyone if you would unmute and share one word, maximum two words. When you think of the word hell, what image enters your mind when you hear the word? What idea immediately enters your mind when you think of hell? One or two words, please unmute and share.
Rather warm.
Warm, okay. Yes, Deborah.
Nothingness.
Nothingness, okay. Anyone else?
A big party with those I know.
A party. Okay.
No connection to God.
Detached from God, okay. And anyone else?
Pain.
What was that, Mike?
Pain,
okay. Was nach? Anyone else?
Punishment.
One or two more? Okay, I think we got, yes, Yuta.
I don't believe in hell.
You don't believe in it?
No.
Okay. You know what? The hell that you don't believe in, I don't either believe in. But tonight, we're going to be learning something new. In all likelihood, your perception of hell may not be 100% the Jewish one. It may be influenced by various other religions, maybe other cultures, maybe just what we muster up in our own mind based on a lot of the words that we just heard tonight and other words and images. So thank you all for sharing, and let's advance. So we're going to ask another question. Before we start our discussion about the afterlife, I'm going to ask a question that relates to life here in this world. I want to ask you to take a minute to open up to page 130 in your student book and take a look at exercise 4.3. We'll take just a quick half a minute to focus on this. On page 130, exercise 4.3, rate the following according to the degree of pleasure they would provide you. 1, least pleasurable, 10, most pleasurable. Just go one by one, either with a pen or make a mental note. In each one of these, rate how much pleasure they would bring you from 1 to 10. Okay. So now that you did that, I want to advance with the first big idea that we're going to be discussing tonight. And here goes. We're going to dive right in and we're going to discuss first and foremost, the fact that God Almighty takes an active interest into human reality, into our actions, and God meets out reward and punishment, reward for those who follow a moral, ethical life, a godly life, and punishment for those who may fall short of that. This is a fundamental Jewish belief. In fact, Maimonides lists 13 principles of the Jewish faith. Of course, number 1 and 2 are belief in one God, not worshiping any others, and other aspects. We're not going to go through them all tonight. One of them is a principle of the Jewish faith is that God takes an interest in human activity and reality and gives out reward for those who follow his word and punishment for those who don't. Let's take a look at text 1a. And I'm going to ask Mike, being that you're at the beginning of my screen, if you would please unmute and read text 1a for starters. This is from Maimonides. Go ahead, please.
The 11th of the 13 principles of Jewish faith is that God, blessed be he, rewards those who observe the commandments of the Torah and punish those who transgress its prohibitions.
Okay, stay unmuted. So is Maimonides talking about reward and punishment during this life or the afterlife? So let's take a look what he says in 1b. Please continue, Mike.
The greatest reward is the pleasures of the world to come. The strongest punishment is to be cut off from the world to come.
Thank you, Mike, for both of those texts. So what is Maimonides saying? Maimonides is telling us that God's reward and punishment comes both in the physical and in spiritual forms. Obviously, we don't understand God's ways. It's unfathomable to us. But Maimonides shares with us and this teaching a fundamental principle belief of Judaism that God rewards both in physical and spiritual form. Now, even though he does so in both the physical and the spiritual, the primary and ultimate form of reward and punishment is actually the spiritual. In other words, not necessarily what we experience here in this life, that we may also experience reward and punishment in this life, but the primary, let's just say time, obviously I don't mean the word time, but the primary phase or reality where we experience reward and punishment from God is in the afterlife. Now, why is this so? Why does the primary reward have to be postponed until later? That's because, obviously, not right now from our perspective, but from God's perspective, which is obviously the real perspective, spiritual pleasure is much greater and much, much more powerful and more pleasurable than physical pleasure. In fact, take a look at the answers that you gave to exercise 4.3. You may notice that you had a preference for spiritual pleasures over physical. So spiritual pleasures are substantially more intense and more enjoyable than those of the physical. And in the options that you looked at in that exercise, love, joy, wisdom, versus a cruise, a country club, social status, wealth, it's very possible that you gave a higher ranking to the spiritual aspects or spiritual sources of pleasure. So, as we'll see, the spiritual pleasures of this world, even in this world we have spiritual pleasures, pale in comparison to any spiritual pleasure that we could have in the next world. So just to sum up what we said so far, number one, Maimonides teaches us that reward and punishment from God is a fundamental Jewish belief. Number two, where does this happen primarily? Not in this world, rather the next world. Because the next world, where things happen in an exclusively spiritual way, it's much more intense, and any pleasure that we could have in this world pales in comparison to the pleasures that we could have in next world. So far, so good? I'll take a quick question. Lou, please.
But at the same time, in Deuteronomy, there's, I don't know which Parsha, but there's a listing of blessings and curses, and those are blessings and curses for this world.
Thank you. So that's in Ki Tavoh, and that's true. And we're not saying that there are no reward and punishment in this world. We're just saying that primarily it happens in the next world, because that's where it's more powerful. Both, it's a spiritual world. So whether, and we'll see later, I don't want to jump the gun. We're going to learn a lot tonight, and we'll have a lot of insight as we move along. Okay, now, before we continue, we have to address the elephant in the room, because when we discuss the nature of reward and punishment in the afterlife, makes many people start feeling uncomfortable when we talk about God and reward and punishment, because it kind of gives us this image of this infinite God. And what's God busy with? He's busy with keeping score of our actions, of our behavior, and he's looking after us. And if I mess up, he's writing it down, and he's saying, I'm gonna get you back for this. I'm gonna keep record of this. It seems a little bit belittling of God's status, of transcending the pettiness of creation, that God follows every act of ours. Is this actually what it means? And not only that, for that matter, why do we even need all these warnings? Why do we need to be enticed or threatened to be a good person? Can't we just be trusted to do the right thing without these bribes or without these threats? It seems a little bit petty to attribute all this to God and say that God is keeping score of our actions and giving us reward or punishment accordingly. So if this crossed your mind, and I'm sure it did in some way, but so let's address this for a minute. On a simple level, we could argue that yes, it's very noble to think that we don't need reward and punishment, but the reality is that we're not perfect human beings. The reality is that it's necessary for many of us, because many of us are or can at least be petty to some degree for some time. And if there wasn't any reward and punishment, what exactly would keep us on the right path? In fact, you may have noticed that we have a police force in our community. You can ask the same thing about that. Why do we have police? Why do we have a judicial system? Can't everyone just behave and everyone just be a good person and move along? Well, I don't know. Not very practical. So on a simple level, we could say the same thing about God. Why do we need this reward and punishment? Because we're imperfect And it helps us stay on the right path, and whether it's out of love or out of fear, and it's helpful. That's just number one. But the bigger idea that I want to share is as follows. And it's not just a bigger idea, it's actually a paradigm shift from the way we think of God and reward and punishment. It's going to be an entirely new way of looking at it, nothing like our understanding of it until now. And for that, we're going to read text number 2, and then we will expound on it. Donna, are you up to reading? If you are, if you can unmute and read text number 2, please.
Okay, I unmuted.
Your sound is a little bit low. Maybe you're far from the microphone. If you could just speak up and drop.
I am temporarily separated from my book. I don't have my book.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. It's also a little low. So, Nadine, would you be up to reading text number 2 for us, please? Thank you.
Sure. Do not consider the punishments described in the Torah as comparable to penalties a person incurs for disobeying the decree of a mortal king. Not at all. Rather, they are completely natural consequences. For one who fails to observe a Torah commandment is denied the good that naturally results from its observance. It is comparable to one who fails to sow his field and therefore cannot reap a harvest, or one who fails to wear clothes and is then cold. It is as natural a consequence as the warmth provided by fire, the wetness of water, and the satiation of bread. In the same way, it is the nature of each mitzvah to provide the positive consequences that are promised for its observance or the negative consequences that are stated regarding its transgression.
Thank you, Nadine, for that. So let's unpack what the Rakanti wrote. This is a 13th century sage and commentator. What did he say? Let's illustrate it like this. You can have two different people who have two different ways of acquiring their food. Okay, number one is a business person. A business person goes to work, works, makes money, and with the money goes and buys food. Then you can have someone who is a farmer. The farmer plows, the farmer sows his field, then reaps the produce and has his food. So we have two different processes here. We have what we're gonna call, the first one is work, money, food. The second one is to sow, reap, and then food. In scenario number one of the business person, is there any intrinsic connection in between his work and his money? No. It happens to be that when you work, you have a very good chance of making money, but you can also work and not make money. Working doesn't guarantee you money. Now, if you have money, is money and food intrinsically connected? No, they're not. Yes, it's a societal convention that with money we go acquire food, but you can also use your money on other things and not buy food. So we just accepted that this is the process we go along with, but this is not, they don't have an intrinsic connection of one to the next. However, for the farmer who has his process of sowing, reaping, and food, that over there is an intrinsic connection. It's not just random. One thing actually produces the next. When you sow and you reap, you actually produce food, and now you can go eat your food. One step is actually leading to the next. They have intrinsic value, an intrinsic connection. So what's the point we're getting to here? The second approach of the farmer is where we have a directly generated consequence from what he does. Similarly, when we talk about our actions producing a reward or punishment, it is not the way we think that God is, so to speak, watching us, and if we mess up, he writes it down and then saves up and piles up a punishment and then gives it to us. No. That's a very flawed way of thinking about it. The real way of thinking about it is that there's a natural consequence from our actions that produce reward and punishment. God's not watching, looking over our shoulder. Not that he's not. God's looking and watching us because he knows everything that's going on. But he's not looking for our next action to see if he should punish us or reward us. Rather, when we do something, there's a natural consequence to our action. If 3 weeks ago, when it was 20 degrees outside in Houston, if I went outside with shorts, then it would be cold, because that's a natural consequence of me not being dressed. It's going to be cold. Similarly, it's a natural consequence. When I do a mitzvah, if I do something right, I'm rewarded as a natural intrinsic consequence. My mitzvah, my act, is what's generating the reward, like the sowing is producing in the field as a direct consequence of what he's doing. Similarly, my mitzvah, or my sin for that matter, I'm not going to be punished because someone's keeping score. It's my very action is producing it. Am I making sense? Yeah, I'm seeing some nods. Okay, so I hope I'm coming across here. Rakanti is telling us that reward and punishment is not an extrinsic consequence or result from our actions, but it's intrinsically connected. And it is not God who is looking to bring punishment upon us. It is my own very actions that are producing the reward, or God forbid, the opposite. Just like to say that the outcomes of our behavior that's described in the Torah are reward and punishment is like saying, in other words, if somebody eats healthy, if someone eats healthy, then they're going to feel healthy, and then they're going to be healthy. If someone eats unhealthy food, they're not being punished by feeling weighed down or not feeling good after they eat something unhealthy. It's a natural consequence of what they're doing. They did it. I ate the extra donut or whatever. So I now feel sluggish. Nobody punished me. It was my very action that produced that feeling. Similarly, that's how it is with any mitzvah or any opposite of a mitzvah. The reward or punishment is a natural consequence of my very actions. And this is true for all forms of reward, both physical and the spiritual. Now, this idea is actually illustrated in a one-line statement from in Ethics of the Fathers. Nick, would you like to read that for us, please? Text number 3 on page 135.
The reward of a mitzvah is a mitzvah. The retribution for a sin is a sin.
Okay. Now, it has a better ring to it in Hebrew. Schar mitzvah, mitzvah. You know what that means? The reward of a mitzvah is a mitzvah. So on a literal level, that means that when I do something good, if I do a mitzvah, my reward is that God will bless me with opportunities to fulfill or encounter more mitzvahs. That's on a basic level. But on a deeper level, what this means is the Mishnah is teaching us that the reward for a mitzvah, or the same applies to punishment, are not external. They are produced by the mitzvah itself. The mitzvah itself and its natural consequence, that is the reward. Let me give you one or two examples for this. If somebody robs somebody else, for example, so yes, it could be that he'll be held accountable in the court system. But you know what this robber's biggest punishment is? He robbed himself of his own dignity. In other words, even if he's not caught, let's say the court system does not catch him. By robbing someone else, you robbed yourself, your very deed. Immediately after doing it, you robbed yourself of your own dignity in the process. It's not some other punishment that's waiting for you. Your action had a natural consequence of impacting you negatively after committing that sin. Say, for example, we have a couple, or it could be in any relationship, but let's just say two spouses. When one spouse isn't respectful to the other, so the biggest issue that awaits this one is not necessarily the punishment that may or may not come. That's not relevant. The biggest issue for this spouse who is speaking disrespectful to his or her spouse, they immediately created a toxic environment in their home and an unsafe environment in the home. Intrinsically connected to the deed is the very natural result that the atmosphere is now impacted. And it's less than peaceful and harmonious in the home as a result of what was just done, regardless of if there's anything else awaiting or not. So this is the idea of what a mitzvah is and what the opposite can be, that it is a natural consequence to our very deed. When we do something, we ourselves are producing the reward or the punishment. I got a question here in the chat. What about all of the good people who lost so much in the floods or the ice storm? So this is a larger question, a very valid question. And the truth is that the Torah teaches, and thank you, Donna, for the question. In other words, the question is, if we are told by God that if we do the right thing and we do mitzvahs and we live a moral, ethical life, then we will be blessed with everything good. Why is it that good people suffer? Quite frankly, it's a general question. It's in the context here of the recent storms or floods in our own city. But why would a righteous person suffer? Why would a wicked person prosper? And the answer is that I already noted that where is the greatest, strongest, most intense form of reward and punishment? Not in this world, in the next. So it's very possible that someone righteous, their real reward is awaiting them in the next world, because that's where the ultimate, more worthwhile, more valuable reward really is. And it's possible that in this world, they may have a less than perfect experience, because any inconvenience, let's say, that God, that they produced by their actions, God may want them to have it in this world where it reflects itself in a physical way. And that way, any punishment they needed is already done with in this world. By the time they get to the next world, they have all the reward awaiting them. Put it this way, from the Jewish perspective, you would much rather, nobody wants to choose suffering and nobody should, God forbid. But the way Judaism teaches us is that when someone suffers in this world, it is a much lighter form of suffering than suffering in the next world. And let's continue with the class, because I think we'll gain a lot of insight as we go through this, unless you have something quick, Sid. No, I thought I saw your hand. No worries. Let's move along. So I hope this idea is coming across well. Let's close this idea with text number 4. Deborah, can I ask you to please read this text? Just unmute yourself on page 136, text 4.
Let me see if I can find myself to unmute.
You're unmuted. Now you're muted.
Now okay. Text 2 on 134.
Number 4. Text 4 on 136.
Oh, sorry. The fires of hell are stoked in direct proportion to the degree which the wicked fan their fiery passions. Accordingly, we must say that Gan Eden, paradise, is amplified by the tremendous passion that the righteous invest in their Torah study and in their performance of God's commandments. They take great pleasure and delight in God himself, and their deeds generate a corresponding abundance of light in God Eden.
Thank you, Deborah. That means paradise. So what we have here is a radically different understanding and perspective of the afterlife. Afterlife is not an existing world. You know, sometimes we muster up these images in our head that paradise is like an exit off to the right and hell is like this exit off to the left, and they lead you to these existing spaces or worlds or realities that are just waiting for your arrival. That's a total misunderstanding of these ideas. And I know for some of us, we have to really let go of certain things, certain paradigms that we held on to maybe for decades. This is a radically different understanding. Heaven, paradise, or hell is not this place that's waiting for us to walk into. It's a reality that we create by our very actions in this world. When I do a mitzvah, everything I do in this world is creating my reality for the next world. It's my behavior, it's my decisions, my conduct in the here and now. I am creating my own reality in my own afterlife. It's not a general place that I'm going to join other people. Deborah, I'm sorry, but that party may just not, it's going to happen, but not over there. It's going to happen in heaven. But it's not that we're going to enter this zone where we walk under the sign of a place called hell. That's a misunderstanding. I hope I'm successfully articulating and conveying what the new idea that we're learning tonight is. Heaven or hell is exactly what we create for ourselves. I create my afterlife, direct consequence of my behaviors. It's not a reward or punishment that's being meted out against me or for me. It's my deeds that are producing my afterlife. Any quick question before we advance? Okay, I guess everyone...
Wait, I have one.
Oh, okay, Deborah.
It's not a question. I'm just going to remark that it sounds like you're saying I'm the producer of my own movie.
Absolutely. I could not have said it better. And movie is actually a good analogy, as we'll see, because there are sources in Torah and Judaism that describe, and we'll get to it, but I'll just give this insight for what's coming. One of the definitions of an afterlife, the afterlife of hell, which we don't yet understand exactly what it is, we'll come to it in a minute. But what happens there is that we're actually, so to speak, shown a movie of our entire life. Our entire life is, so to speak, replayed before us. Obviously, we're using physical terms of movies, which don't exist there. But our whole life is like reviewed before our eyes, and we get to re-experience life, and all the decisions that we made are revisited. But I don't want to jump ahead. We'll get to it in just a couple minutes. Anyone else? Anyone else need anything clarified? Anything that I said? Okay, I guess it's all clear. So after this introduction, where we explained the ideas of heaven and hell in Judaism, it's not reward and punishment the way we always thought of it. Rather, it's our own doing, our own reality that we create based on how we live our life. Now we're going to understand, we're going to explore a little bit more and understand what exactly is hell and heaven. And we always like the bad news first, so we're going to start with hell. So, does Judaism believe in a hell? Big question of tonight's class. Yuta asked the question. She didn't really ask the question. She made a statement, actually. So the truth is that Judaism does believe in a form of hell, but it's radically different from what the popular conception of it is. And that's why it's better if we use the term in Hebrew, Gehenom, or purgatory, because that's really what it is. It's not the hell that we think or always conjure up in our mind. But if I use the term, it doesn't mean I'm using the popular meaning of the term, but I'm referring to the Jewish concept of it. So generally speaking, what is hell thought of? It's thought of to be a punishment for bad behavior. Someone lived a life, an unethical, immoral life. They made bad decisions. So they're going to be sent. They're going to be condemned to eternal damnation in the furnaces of purgatory. That's the popular thinking, that this is a destination, and people who were no good during their life end up there. Now, it's a disturbing notion, of course, Nobody wants to end up in a place like that and be banished to a place like that for eternity. Now, so what is it? We just said what it's not. What hell is not, is in the Jewish belief, it's not a destination. So what is it? I think it could best be described as a rehabilitation center. Okay, a lot of people that I know right now, unfortunately, who are in the hospital for COVID, whether here or in other cities around the world, and if they had a tough ride, so they finish healing or they heal to a certain degree in the hospital, then they have to go to rehab. I know people right here in Houston in rehab right now. Why do they go to rehab? Because the hospital did whatever it can for them, but they're not quite ready to go home. And they need a phase in between. Of course, destination is to get home, but they still need rehab to help them be fully ready to go home and be able to live at home, take care of themselves, and go back to life the way it was before they got sick. So hell as a rehabilitation center means like this. It's the destination for almost every soul. Not maybe there are radical exceptions, maybe one in a generation, but I'm just going to say every soul. Every soul ends up in heaven. You may be surprised to learn this today. Every single soul ends up in heaven. The destination for everyone is heaven. There's no such thing as being banished to hell for good. Doesn't exist in the Jewish belief. What does exist is that when someone lives their life here in this world, so every day, every hour, sometimes every minute, we're confronted by decisions that we have to make in life. We can choose right, we can choose wrong. Now, when we choose right, when we do something good, let's just say, for example, if someone gives charity, who benefited when somebody gives charity? Now, an obvious beneficiary is the recipient of their charity, because somebody was just helped. Somebody was hungry, who was fed, a good cause was helped. So the recipient, of course, is the number one person to benefit. But besides the recipient benefiting from charity, you know who else benefits? The giver of the charity. When I give charity, you know what it does to me and to anyone who gives charity? An act of giving charity turns the person into a more giving person. I don't know if you know this, in Judaism, of course, how much you give to charity is important. We have to give 10% minimum of our earnings, not for now. But there's another thing that's equally important. How often we give charity is as important as how much. In other words, I could take the same $100, give it in one gifting, or I can give $1 100 times. I should be doing both. Now, if I want to give 100, I shouldn't delay it. I should give it. But in addition, I should also give $1 a day to charity, because every time I give charity, it turns me into a more giving person. And the same is true with any mitzvah that we do. It refines us. It enhances our relationship with God. It does something positive for us, the person doing the mitzvah. Sadly, the opposite is also true. If someone commits a sin or violates a certain commandment, so it's not just that they may have, God forbid, hurt someone else. But when a person engages in something they shouldn't, their soul is becoming tainted, negatively or spiritually tainted. Now, you can't negatively impact a soul directly. A soul is pure. The soul is pristine. The soul is a piece of God. But think of a diamond. A diamond can collect layers and layers of dust, and you can conceal the beauty of the diamond. The same is with a soul. A soul, you can't change a soul, but you can cover it and conceal the beauty of the soul. And someone who engages in a lot of unhealthy behaviors, their soul can become more and more concealed, more and more buried, more and more inaccessible. It doesn't mean it's not there. They never lose it. It's always there. You can always reclaim it through hard work, through repentance. But anything we do negative leaves a negative stain on our soul. Okay, so the soul departs from this world. and it goes, it moves upward, it leaves the body. So the soul, as we said, every soul is going to end up in heaven. The problem is, for many of us, because of the life we lived here in this world, and it doesn't mean anyone wicked, all of us, we just for the basic mainstream mistakes that we all make, we gather a certain negative spiritual stain. And the result of that is that our soul isn't quite ready to jump into heaven the moment it leaves this world. It needs to enter rehab. Again, I want to emphasize, every soul is going to end up in heaven, but it needs to relearn the language of heaven. Because after living life on earth in a body for that long, for 70, 80, 90, 120 years, please God, the reality is the soul was in a body. The reality is the soul needed physical things and materialism in order to live in a body. And the reality is that every human being makes mistakes. So because of that, the result of that is that the soul isn't quite ready to re-enter heaven. So this is what hell is in the Jewish belief. It's a phase. It's a rehabilitation center where the soul goes through a cleansing process. And in so doing, it makes itself capable and it readies itself to be able to enter heaven and actually appreciate heaven once again. In fact, if the soul is thrown straight into heaven after leaving earth, it won't even know how to relate to where it is, because it's not conducive. It's like going outside in the cold or just not having the right tools or the right clothing. You can't go up to space without a very specific outfit that an astronaut wears. If you're not wearing it, you won't be able to relate to your reality. Similarly, the soul needs to go through this process called hell, where it's cleansed and rehabilitated, and in so doing, it becomes ready to re-enter and appreciate the rewards of heaven. Let's read text number 6. If I can ask Lynn to please do so. It's on page 139, text number 6, from Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Liadi. Let's hear his description.
The purpose of Gehenna is to refine the soul and rid it of any sickness that it contracted. This is similar to the process of smelting silver, wherein the dross and the sediment is burned away in a furnace, leaving the silver clean and free of impurities. Similarly, the soul to be able to experience the light of pleasures and bask in God's radiance, it must first be refined in the spiritual fire of Gehenna, whereby the negative is purged from the positive.
Thank you very much, Lynn. So a better name for Gehenna or hell would actually be soul catharsis. The soul is actually it's actually being helped. In other words, it's actually ironically, it's a blessing for the soul to go to hell, as strange as that sounds, because the experience there is actually going to allow it to re-enter heaven sooner than later and re-experience heaven. In fact, it is worse for a soul to be in limbo and not enter heaven or hell than it is to actually go to hell, but knowing that there's a specific purpose for being there, and you get on with it and make your way over to the destination, which of course is heaven. So what is the nature of this painful experience that is hell? Now, we're not saying that this is fun and games, by the way. I want to be very clear. Even though it's just a phase, it's just a phase that the soul goes through, and it's very purpose-oriented, but it doesn't mean that it's fun. It's not at all fun. It's actually very painful for the soul. It's a spiritual pain, and it's even worse than physical pain. We think we know what pain is. Spiritual pain is even more intense and worse than that. So what is it? What really happens there? So let's go on to text number 7. Eloise, would you like to read that, please? please unmute.
Okay, starting at the bottom.
Text number 7 from Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan.
Then an individual will also see himself in a new light. Even in our mortal physical state, looking at oneself can sometimes be pleasing and in other times very painful. Imagine standing naked before God with your memory wide open, completely transparent, without any jamming mechanism or reducing valve to diminish its force. You will remember everything you ever did. You will see it in the light of the unshaded spirit, or if you will, in God's own light that shines from one end of creation to the other. The memory of every good deed and mitzvah will be the sublimest of pleasures, but your memory will also be open to all the things of which you are ashamed. They cannot be rationalized away or dismissed. You will be facing yourself, fully aware of the consequences of all your deeds. We will know the terrible shame and humiliation experienced when one is caught in the act of doing something wrong. Imagine being caught by one's own memory with no place to escape. A member of our great teachers, Yosef Albo Ikarim, Menashe ben Israel, Nishmat Sham, write that the fire of Gehenna is actually the burning shame one experiences because of one's own sins. Of course, these concepts, as used by our sages, may also contain deeper mysteries and meanings, but a major ingredient of this fire may be shame. How else could one characterize the agony of unconcealed shame upon a soul? We are taught that the judgment of the wicked lasts 12 months. The pain eventually subsides.
Thank you, Eloise. So I'm getting a question here if this applies to everyone. Yes, it applies to everyone. And I did note that there are radical exceptions to this, maybe one in a generation, etc. Otherwise, every soul does end up in heaven. So I think to understand this, you know, if anyone ever had to maybe ask or apologize to someone for something that we may have done. We may have wronged somebody, maybe we delayed asking for forgiveness for a long time, but the moment came when we just decided we shouldn't delay it anymore. Who knows what's gonna be tomorrow, we're gonna do it. And you have to confront the person, admit what you did, and ask for forgiveness. That moment, it's a very difficult thing to do. That's why, not as many people that should be doing this do it. And that's why a lot of relationships are never repaired, because people are not ready to go through this painful experience of confronting something that we've done. And I'm talking about right here in this lifetime for another human being. Now, hopefully, if we're able to do it, and everyone makes mistakes, we can all relate to this. We all needed to do it at some point in our life. If we are able to do so, yes, it's very painful, but it's also extremely cathartic when we do so, when we're able to do so. It helps us heal. We come out, we emerge much better, healthier, and stronger afterwards, and cleansed quite literally from from that experience, as painful as it was. So now we have to think of Gehenna as being that times over and over for our whole life, where we revisit with every moment of our whole life, and it's just you and God, and we have to confront the very raw feelings of how we experienced that during our lifetime when it actually happened. And we're gonna, at that point, there's no, you know, in Yiddish they say to drei akop, there's no twisting the truth, there's no excuses. All that is only here in this world. At that point, when it's just you and God, there's nothing of that anymore. And quite frankly, we have no interest in even coming up with excuses there, because it's a world of truth and we don't want anything but the truth. So as painful as it is also very cathartic for the soul. Someone's asking if the soul gets a lawyer. I mean, there's a concept, well, obviously not exactly the way you're asking it, but there is a concept of an advocate on high. In fact, when somebody passes away, we always say that they should be a good advocate for us. In Yiddish, we say, may they be a guter better. Now, what that means is, even for us now, we are here in this world, but we ask of our loved one to be an advocate for us on high, even while we're still here. So, you know, somebody once came up to heaven, and his life was being reviewed exactly the way we're describing it. And then it came to charity. We were just talking about charity, and it was being reviewed if he gave sufficient charity according to his means, and he was coming up short. So right there and then he takes out his checkbook and he writes a big check for whatever he should have during his lifetime. And the angel tells him, I'm sorry, over here we don't take checks. We only take receipts. So the mitzvah can only be done here in this world. Once we're there, it's all too late. Once we're there, we're in a world of truth. And like we noted already in earlier lessons, to make a difference, and we'll come back to it soon, to make a difference that we can only do while we're here. But we'll come back to that shortly. One last thought on this idea. If we have if your shirt got dirty and you have to put your shirt into the washing machine, you're never going to tell your shirt that your shirt is being banished to the washing machine, right? Doesn't make sense. It's going to the washing machine because it's a cleansing process, but then it's going to come out on the other end. It's going to come out clean. Similarly, the soul is not banished to hell. It's a very specific thing. It's a process. You can think of it as spiritual washing machine, but that is how, by confronting the raw, naked truth of everything we did throughout our whole lifetime, that is how we become cleansed. It's painful, but it's that process when we don't come up with any excuses anymore and we face the raw truth of everything we did, that is actually how we are cleansed. And by doing that, we end up coming out on the other end clean and ready to experience the full scope of heaven. Okay. I see someone's asking about repentance. Colin, thank you, and we'll touch upon that shortly. Thank you for asking it. So how long does somebody spend in hell? Right? That was the next question everyone's thinking. Okay, we reduced it. We know it's not the destination, but how long do we have to go through this? So in text number 8, what do we have? It's a one-liner from the Mishnah. This goes back over 2,000 years in Jewish writings, where it says that the maximum sentence of the wicked in Gehenna is 12 months. Phew, we just brought it down to 12 months. Good news, maximum 12 months. So at the conclusion of 12 months, even the most sinful of souls is sufficiently purified and is able to enter paradise. Now, as I noted, every soul ends up there. And we're not going to read it, but text number 9 gives us a Mishnah that tells us that every soul ends up in heaven. Now, it's true for everyone. Now, we should also point out, like Colin noted and asked about before, that yes, it's true that we have to go through this process, but we can actually impact this process when we're here in this world. So if I did something wrong, or many things wrong, if I repent, and we know that we have a Yom Kippur in Judaism, but we also know that we're not supposed to wait until Yom Kippur. If I did something wrong today, I shouldn't wait till Yom Kippur to repent. You know, there's always emails that go out a couple months before Yom Kippur. It says, repent now, you can beat the rush. So we shouldn't wait till Yom Kippur. Of course, Yom Kippur is the one day of the year where we think about the whole year as a whole, but we should always be engaged in repenting. In fact, every day in our prayers, we have a few paragraphs of the confessional prayer, because every day we need those thoughts of confessing anything that we may have done wrong, even lighter things, lighter transgressions, and we immediately repent. And now the power of repentance is that we actually cleanse our soul. So we can actually diminish the amount of time we need in purgatory by repentance that we engage in here in this world. Okay, so I think we described what purgatory is, and we also said that the longest it takes for someone to become clean and ready to enter heaven is 12 months. And I know we got the question in a previous class, so maybe I'll address it right now. Someone asked about Kaddish, and we're going to talk about Kaddish soon, but I just want to talk about this one aspect of it. So I know I've been sharing tidbits about my own experience this year with you throughout this journey. I'm not just here as a lecturer or a teacher, but I'm actually living through this very much, this time of teaching this course. So this coming Saturday, I'm actually going to conclude reciting Kaddish. So I said Kaddish every single day for the last about 10 months and 3 weeks. My life revolved around it for the last almost 11 months. Just as an example, I mean, last Thursday, I flew to New York for a nephew's bar mitzvah just for one evening, but all my flights revolve around being able to not miss any Kaddish. So I said Kaddish here Thursday morning. At 10 o'clock, I flew to New York. Evening, afternoon, and evening services I did in New York before the bar mitzvah. Friday morning, I did morning services in Brooklyn. And from the shul, I went straight to LaGuardia Airport and landed here at 12:30 so I can be here for Shabbat. Now, I've even had, about 6 months ago, I wasn't able to find the flight that accommodated the service times, because earlier in COVID, there were maybe one or two flights a day to New York. Now there's already more, there's five, etc. So I actually had to fly in the evening. But I was lucky enough to spot Jews on my flight from Houston Bush Airport that flew to Newark. And I actually collected 10 Jews on the plane, and I gathered them to the back of the plane, and I actually said Kaddish in the middle of a flight from Houston to Newark. This was not New York, Tel Aviv. This was Houston to New York, and we had a full-on minyan. I even have a selfie to prove it. If you ever want to see it, you can ask me. The point I'm making here is that it very much defines life, and it's a very powerful connection that exists and is maintained throughout the entire first year. I conclude saying Kaddish this coming Shabbat for Mincha. After our Kiddush lunch, we're going to have a Mincha service this week, and that's going to be my last Kaddish. And of course, not until the Yahrzeit, which is the day of the anniversary of passing. A friend of mine who called me, I think it was just a few days after I concluded Shiva, about 11 months ago, and he had lost his mother. He's my age. He lost his mother maybe 5 or 8 years ago. And he told me what someone told him when he was sitting Shiva. He said someone came to visit him and told him that one of your hardest days and this whole process is going to be the first day after you stop saying Kaddish. Because as long as you are saying Kaddish, you maintain a very active and live connection with your loved one. Because look, it's already 10 and a half months since losing my father, but my day is revolving around him, literally, every single day. Right before I gave this class, I was in Southwest Fondren for Kaddish. I came back at 7:15, 7:20 to be here for the class. So my life is literally revolving around him a whole day. The day that this finishes actually starts a new phase. And it's difficult to let go, as we described in last week's class, that as much as we know intellectually that we need to advance, but nonetheless, emotionally, we may not always be there. But we still have to do what we need to do, and our emotions will follow our actions. So, why am I sharing all this? Because people asked, and I did get the question in one of the previous lessons, in why we conclude saying Kaddish 1 month early. So we just said in a previous text that the longest somebody needs to be in purgatory in this cleansing process is 12 months. And if our Kaddish, as we'll soon see, helps that process, why are we only doing it for 11 months and not 12? And the answer is that we never, ever want to assume that our loved one needed the longest time possible and the longest time necessary in purgatory. Someone who needs to be there for 12 months means they needed the longest cycle in the washing machine. That's pretty desperate. Yes, even they will end up in heaven, but 12 months, a full 12 months, doesn't say a whole lot of good about that person. So we all conclude at 11 months, and in doing so, we're saying that our loved one is certainly not someone who needs the complete 12 months of Kaddish. So let's just talk for one moment about, we talked about what hell is from the Jewish perspective. And you know what, is there one or two quick questions? We still have a lot to advance within our time limit, but before I go on, I would like to take a question or two. You know what, one question, please. Ron.
So after death, is the soul alone? Is there an escort? Is there directions? You know, Gehonim this way? Like, how do you get there? What if you don't know how to get there?
So obviously certainly no space and even no time the way we know time. Now I know I just gave a whole timeline to the process of the soul, but the soul itself obviously maybe is not experiencing time. There's time the way we are able to relate to what's going on in heaven. And this is what was revealed to us through our sages of Israel over the generations. But there's no time and space. The soul is not alone because the soul is escorted by angels, certainly. And this whole process is one where you're being engaged and you're being helped. Like I said, this is a catharsis. You're not alone in rehab. You're being helped. So whatever angels are assigned to look after this particular soul is certainly making sure the soul is being escorted throughout this whole process. So let's continue, and I'm happy to take more questions at the end if necessary. So we talked about hell, but what does heaven look like? So the truth is that we're not going to spend a lot of time on heaven, and that's because we don't know exactly what it is. We know what it's not. The reason why we don't know what it is because, as we noted earlier, we are physical human beings, and we have no way to fathom spiritual reality. As text 10 tells us, someone who cannot see, God forbid, and they never saw in their life, it's very hard to explain someone like that what colors are. Maybe you can give them some vague idea, but if they never experienced it, there's no way to explain it to them. Similarly, for us here in this world, there's no way to really explain us and it's not possible for us to get an understanding of what it is, but we could get a little bit of an understanding of what it's not. So I'm going to ask Anne, if you're up to it, if you can please read text 11 to help us with that.
Yes.
Thank you.
In the hereafter, there is no eating, drinking, procreation, commerce, jealousy, hatred, or competition. Rather, the righteous sit, their heads adorned with crowns, and they delight in the radiance of the divine presence.
Thank you. When we say crowns, obviously we don't mean physical, we mean divine radiance that adorns them. But let's talk about pleasure. So there's various different types of pleasure in this world that we know of. And as we grow up, we develop a taste for more refined or more sophisticated pleasures. But what's certain, what we all know is that there's no greater pleasure than an intimate relationship. It could be obviously a spouse, it could be a close relationship with a parent, a sibling, a close friend. A close intimate relationship with another human being is from the greatest pleasures that a person can have on many levels. Similarly, and again, it's hard for us to really appreciate this because this is the soul's occupation, and we are very much defined by our body. But even when the soul is here in a body in this world, the soul has one interest. The soul's sole purpose, no pun intended, is to engage in a relationship with God Almighty. That's the sole occupation and interest of the soul, to be in an intimate relationship with God. When we do a mitzvah here, our soul is strengthening that bond, strengthening that connection to God. Obviously, the opposite severs that connection to some extent. But the soul always wants, and its greatest satisfaction comes from an intimate relationship with God Almighty. And like I said, that happens in this world through mitzvahs. What happens in the next world? When the soul gets to heaven, the soul is the experience of our relationship with God. When the soul was here in this world, the soul was doing all kinds of things to foster and strengthen its bond with God. But the soul doesn't really experience it in this world because the soul is in a body and the soul is engaging in a lot of other things. But every time it does a mitzvah, it's creating and strengthening and enhancing its bond with God. When does it experience this intimacy with God? When the soul reaches heaven. That's when everything the soul did, all the good things it did, all the enhancing this connection that it did throughout its life, it experiences it when it's in heaven. That's what happens there. And it experiences it in paradise. The soul craves one thing, an unrestricted relationship with its creator, with God Almighty. And that is the only definition that we have of paradise, that the soul actually gets to experience what it craved all along. All it wants is a relationship with God, and it gets to experience that in heaven. And that's the greatest pleasure for the soul. So with the little bit of time that we have left, we're going to talk about what our role is in all this after the soul already departed this world and ascended on high. Do we still play a role? Can we make an impact at this stage? So the thing is like this. Even though we talk about heaven as a place where the soul basks in its relationship with God, in heaven, in holiness, holiness is infinite. So whatever bond the soul creates and has with God, let's say at any given moment, it can attain and achieve an even greater bond with God. God is infinite. So as close as the soul is with God, it can even get closer. And it wants to get closer because, like I said, God's infinite. It's not like once you get to know a person, you kind of have them down pat, and then you get bored of them, and then, God forbid, you have to move on to the next person. No. And this is really the way a marriage should be here below. We should always be wanting to discover. We should always be more and more curious about our spouse. But this is not a marriage class. We're going to get to that a different time. The point is about the soul and God. The soul wants to discover more and more of God, that it now is basking in this divine light. So once it's in heaven, what happens then? Okay, let's say it went through its whatever number of months were necessary. It's now in heaven. Does it just find its place and get settled? The answer is no. It constantly wants to ascend higher and higher. And it actually does advance. And it takes steps forward and gets closer and closer to God. But on a regular basis, these steps are basically what we're going to call, we'll just call them baby steps. Once a year, the soul has the opportunity to take a big, giant leap forward and get a lot closer to God. And that is on what we call the Yahrzeit, which is on the anniversary of passing every year. On the day of the Yahrzeit, everything that this soul stood for, what this person's, what his or her life was defined by, If you recall in a previous lesson, we talked about the fact that when someone passes away, at that moment, their soul becomes fully accessible, and the full power of their soul becomes fully accessible, because a lot of it is limited during our lifetime. So that access and that shining forth of what this person stood for, every year on the yard site happens over again. Their energy, their soul is more accessible that day because what they stood for is more accessible to us. And on this day, they also have the ability to advance and leap forward in their connection to God. And this is why every year on the yard site, we do various things to help this leap forward of the soul. So we actually play a role in this process on an annual basis on the day of the yard site. How do we do that? So number one, like we said before, we say Kaddish every year on the yard site of a loved one. That's number one. Number two, we do mitzvahs. And mitzvahs are in a way even more important than Kaddish. By giving charity, by doing action-oriented mitzvahs in this world, like we touched on in previous lessons, the soul can't do that now because it's not here anymore. And it's us who can make a difference in this world on behalf of the soul. When we do that, we actually help this process, this annual process and this leap forward that the soul takes on the day of the anniversary of passing, on the day of the yard site. Let's read this very important text. Jim, if you're up to it, can I ask you to please read text number 12?
Okay.
On page 146, text 12.
Oh, sorry. Okay. When individuals act righteously and are outstanding in the service of their Creator, they generate tremendous merit for the souls of their parents. This merit is simply by virtue of their parents having served as the instruments of their births. It is the parents who enabled their soul to be born into this world, which in turn enabled the many righteous deeds that they perform. The parents, therefore, have a share in their meritorious acts. However, anyone's charity or prayers on behalf of a departed person are beneficial for the soul of the deceased. It is therefore a Jewish custom to give charity and do other good deeds on behalf of the deceased in order to cause satisfaction to the soul.
Thank you very much, Jim. So we have something very interesting here. What we're saying here is that there's a difference in between the offspring of that person, the people who are closest to that individual versus other people. So their own family and certainly parents to children, when a child does something, any good deed at any time, it helps and is a merit to the parent who passed on. In other words, if the child isn't even thinking, they're not even meditating before doing that good deed, that it should be on behalf or in the merit of their parent, just doing a mitzvah is a merit to the parent. Why is that? Because when a child does something good, it's logically, its default is that who brought that child into the world? It was the father or the mother. So if a child that was brought into the world by someone is now going and doing something good, so that is credited to the parent who is now in heaven. And again, the child doesn't even have to be thinking before it that I'm doing it or thinking their name. Even if it's, you're not even thinking, just doing a good deed is a merit to the soul of a parent. Now, what about someone else? What if I want to do something good to someone I knew who passed on, but I'm not related to them? So in that case, I need to do so intentionally. It has to be an intentional deed. If I think that I'm doing this in the merit of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, it helps them in their process of ascending on high, whether it's on their yard site or during the first 12 months. So obviously children have an extra special opportunity to impact the journey of their parent on high. And every mitzvah that they do enhances and makes it easier on the departed soul when it's a child to a parent. And as we noted, this every year on the yard site, there are a lot of things that we can do to help this process. The first 12 months are the most powerful because later on, it's only once a year that they experience an ascent. During the first 12 months, it's an ongoing process every single day. This is why we do things every day and any opportunity that we have to add merit to their soul, because the first year is the most critical and the most auspicious. After that, it's once a year, and also on holidays, we four times a year, we recite the Yizkor memorial service, and we also pledge to charity when we do so. Again, action-oriented mitzvah is always the highest priority. So I'm not going to read through it, but I do want you to take a look at figure 4.2 and 4.3 on pages 147 and 148. Excuse me. And here we have various different mitzvahs or positive things that you can do to bring merit to the soul of the departed, whether it's in general. In 4.2, it's things that you can do all year. During the first year, any opportunity to give charity, study Torah, support Torah study, support a Torah class, donate books of Torah to a synagogue or a Jewish library, etc., or take part in writing a Torah scroll. These are all great ideas that bring merit to the soul. In 4.3, we have a number of customs and traditions that we do on an annual basis on the day of the yard site, again, to help that process. So we just have a couple minutes left, and I just want to talk very briefly about Kaddish, which we already discussed before, but it's possibly the most well-known Jewish mourning custom is the recital of Kaddish. And in text 13, which we're not going to read, we have the text of Kaddish, but really what it is, if you read it, you'll see that there's nothing there about mourning. There's nothing in Kaddish that talks about losing a loved one. What we say there is just the opening line is exalted and hallowed be his great name. We're basically praising God. What is the meaning of this? What's the connection to saying this after the loss of a loved one? For that, we're going to go to a very important and powerful text, number 14. And I will ask, let's see. Lou, could you please read this one for us? Text 14 on page 151, written by Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who himself passed away in the last 6 months sometimes, who was from the greatest sages among the Jewish people today.
Every member of the community of Israel is, in a sense, among those who establish and proclaim God's sovereignty in this world. As the verse states, "You, Israel, are my witnesses," God declares. Therefore, the absence of any individual creates a void, as it were, in God's sovereignty in the world. In order to fill this void, others need to intensify their work and to proclaim on their own behalf, as well as on behalf of the deceased, "Exalted and hallowed be his great name." With this perspective, we can understand why reciting the Kaddish elevates the soul of the deceased. The aggregate of a person's actions and accomplishments in this world define his or her life. However, the tally of a person's achievements does not necessarily conclude at the moment of death. A complete evaluation of a person's accomplishments must also include all that is accomplished as a result of the person's inspiration and actions. Therefore, when those who remain alive, and especially the person's children and descendants whose very existence is a credit to their forebears, do good deeds, they contribute to the deceased's balance of accomplishments. For although the deceased is no longer active in this world, his or her actions continue to inspire positive deeds and actions. That's why the recitation of Kaddish elevates the soul, because God is being exalted in this world as a result and in the name of the deceased.
Thank you very much, Lou. And that really expresses very powerfully what Kaddish is all about. When someone passes away, a void is left in the world because a soul left the world, a piece of God left this world. And God, so to speak, God's presence needs to be restored. And that space where that person filled, which now is, that person is now missing, we need to fill that space with God's presence. And that's what we achieve by saying Kaddish. And of course, it brings merit to the soul of the deceased because it's to their credit and their inspiration and their education and their teachings that brought us to the place that we appreciate doing so and we actually do so. So just a closing thought here. Imagine a researcher comes up and discovers the cure for cancer. And because of their discovery, they're now going to bring healing to millions and millions of people. And as a result, they're nominated and they win the Nobel Prize and they are brought to Sweden with their family to celebrate their achievements. The moment of receiving the award for this scientist who made this global discovery may actually be anticlimactic. In other words, to get an award for an achievement of this magnitude almost seems petty. Because what could compare for this scientist, what could compare to the moment that he realized that he actually made the discovery and actually did something and brought something about that's going to bring healing to millions and millions of people around the world? Nothing can compare to that. The fact that he's going to get an award in Sweden is insignificant to the moment that he actually achieves it. So our closing thoughts for lesson four is this. Even though we spoke a lot tonight about heaven and about the rewards waiting for us in heaven, but where does life go down? As far as Judaism is concerned, life goes down here on earth. What happens in heaven is secondary, even though that is where the primary reward happens. But where do we achieve? Where do we earn the reward? That happens here on earth. So nothing is comparable. And any reward that we will get in heaven is all pales in comparison to the ability that we have in the here and now, which is to actually make a difference in the world, to actually do a mitzvah, to actually fulfill God's will, to actually be there for another human being. One act like this, an action-oriented mitzvah, a deed done in this world, is the most powerful thing. That is where it's all at. Everything else is secondary. So in closing, let us all utilize the time that we have, every day that we have. Every day is a gift. Every hour is a gift. Every moment is a gift. And the more that we do, the more deeds that we do, number one, this is the greatest priority and the greatest achievement that we could have, is actually making the discovery which happens here. And for any of our loved ones who are now on high, we have the ability to actually impact their journey on high by doing things in their honor, in their merit. The more we do, the more we impact their intimacy with God Almighty. Thank you all for joining lesson four. And we, of course,